This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Hey, everyone. I'm Jessica from the Leaving the Village podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning into this show. We're so grateful that you've decided to spend your time with us. Seriously, Dan, Gail, Kathleen, Nate, Scott, and the rest of us here at the Dauntless Media Collective couldn't produce content like the show you're listening to without your support. I'd also like to invite you even further into the conversation. Right now, there are some great discussions happening over in the Dauntless Media Collective Discord server. If you're interested in chatting with other folks who are deconstructing and decolonizing the oppressive traditions they came from, please feel free to hop onto the server. If you don't know what Discord is, it's a place where communities can gather online for chatting on a wide variety of topics. In our Discord server, we have channels devoted to general deconstruction conversations, some meme sharing, therapeutic venting about whatever religious bullshit you're currently dealing with, and even a channel specifically devoted to talking about the latest episode of the podcast you're listening to right now. I hope you'll join us. You can log in directly to the Dauntless server by clicking on the link in the show notes or heading to dauntless.fm and clicking on the link in the top banner. See you there.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter. Podcast.
We're here, your hosts, Cortland and
Megan, and we get to hang out on what this episode's coming out, what, tomorrow? We get to hang out on Thursday. We're going to start getting the week going. It's the week of content warning.
We're excited. Excited isn't even enough of a word. I'm ecstatic. I can't think of hardly anything else. I'm just like wandering around my house, giggling and smiling to myself. It's a great week.
It's what's really amazing is I love these events because all of our favorite people get to be in one space. But also, I have to tell you that for folks that are coming or have seen our website, at the end of our first night, we're going to do karaoke. And I was talking to the guy who's running our karaoke for us. And we did karaoke at his club last time we did an event together. And they had a few CCM titles that got busted out towards the end of the night. And I was telling him like how that was kind of a funny piece that, you know, and how the community that we are. And he was like, oh, yeah, I used to go to, and he goes, what is it called? Youth group. And I'm like, oh, and you're going to love this group of people.
Yes.
It's a great fit.
I love it so much. It's going to be fun. We're really excited about the virtual attendees. So we're excited to hang out with all of those folks. If you have not signed up and you're wanting to sign up all the way up until pretty much the day before, I guess, the night before, I don't know, a few hours before, you
can
probably get signed up.
Okay, in person, you can sign up. You know, you could come at the door and sign up. Virtual, you could actually, I don't recommend doing this, but you could actually sign up after the event and get the recorded sessions. I think you're going to get the most bang for your buck to come and hang out with us during the event because you can participate in the chat. And if there's questions, we'll be connecting, you know, virtual attendees with the people live. But I think if you start seeing buzz about it and you're like, oh man, I wish I would have been there, you can still pay $35 and get the recording.
Yeah, I'm gonna be on Twitter and such day of, like, hyping it up, trying to get people to come hang out, because I think we talked about schedule today. I think the first panel I'm gonna be hanging out, helping to moderate online. The online attendees. And so from the get, I'll be hanging out with the online folks. And there's already, I've got friends here in Denver who are going to be hanging out. I've got a couple people that are going to be like having like a watch party together. So anyway, lots of cool ideas, things you could do for your President's Day weekend. Instead of celebrating presidents, come hang out with us instead.
Or Valentine's Day, maybe.
Or Valentine's Day, yeah. Okay. Or like the beginning of Lent.
I also have to tell you that I stopped by Shebop, which is a sex toy shop in Portland, and I actually hadn't been in there before. They're one of our sponsors, but they gave us a gift bag to raffle off, and I peeked inside the gift bag. I'm not gonna reveal what's in it right now, but it is awesome. I'm definitely gonna be buying some raffle tickets for this. It is amazing. So
yes,
that's one of my favorite things right now because I have that sitting in my apartment and in this gift bag, and I'm excited to see who the lucky winner is.
That's so exciting. Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. So. Contentwarningevent.com. If you have no idea what we're talking about, you have missed the last several episodes, and that's totally cool. You're here for this one. We're telling you about it now. And do we have anything else to cover before we jump into this interview? We have so many cool interviews lined up. We've been a little behind.
Yeah, and I think we should just jump in because Carly is amazing. We've had this interview in the queue for a couple weeks now and loved, loved, loved having this conversation. I cannot wait for her book to come out. And I think it's going to be a really important one. It's going to add a piece to the story that just to kind of add a new perspective and an intersectional perspective. And so I think I loved talking with her. I could have talked, we say this about a lot of our guests, but could have talked to her for a lot longer. But
oh, hours.
I think we should just get into it.
Yeah. I'm excited for y'all to hear it. Let's just jump right into the conversation with Carly. All right. Another episode of the Day After Podcast. We have a guest that I'm very excited about, author of upcoming book that you're going to find out about. Of course, I'm here with my co-host, Megan. Welcome.
Hey, hey. And welcome, Carly. It's so good to have you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll just kick off. We would love to hear a little bit about kind of your, how you grew up, just to, you know, what's your context that you're coming from, especially as you're just in writing your book too.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's just kind of cliche at this point to be like, I started writing a book in quarantine in 2020, but that is true. That's literally what I did, because in my little corner of BC, Canada, near Vancouver, we have a young son and a daughter, and our son is quite medically complex, and so we just bundled up at home, and I found myself with a lot of time on my hands, and I was able to go through sort of my whole life, every memory I could think of from about age 3 to current times, and just try to unravel some things and make sense of some things. And that I started that, you know, almost 4 years ago now. So I'm probably even a different person than I was when I started writing it, but the overall theme and the message or the lessons that I came to conclusion about are still ultimately the same. So my book is called Apocalypse Child because I grew up the first 10 years of my life or so in Montana, and we were very evangelical, conservative, and it was just me and my single mom. That was kind of our family unit. And so I kind of just took everything that she said as, you know, almost like God, like, you said it, that settles it. This is what we're doing. And so when she started to get really into like end of the world, you know, Y2K and Revelation and all this kind of like Left Behind, like all these things sort of started happening at the same time in the 90s. And that was just normal to me. I was like, oh, like this is in the Bible. People are writing books about it. People are having dreams about it. And so it must be true. It must be what's happening. And combine the religious aspect of it with a really, I guess, suspicion or a distrust of the American government and trusting conspiracy theories and different, you know, ideas. It like it all kind of made this weird religious, political, like meshed up thing that was our reality. And my mom decided that the U.S. was no longer a safe place to live, and especially would not be when Y2K happened and the world ended, essentially. So she moved us to the middle of nowhere in BC, in a little town called Smithers. It's about halfway up the province, about a 14-hour drive from the border. And we bought a 300-acre property 45 minutes outside of town, no electricity, and we lived in cabins and stocked barns up with end-of-the-world supplies and waited out there for a few years. And wow. Yeah, so I lived out there from age 11 to 15, and Y2K didn't happen. You know, 9/11 happened, and we thought, oh, okay, now it's really going to start now. Like, this is,
yeah,
you know, it was just a little late. You know, our timing and our predictions and our prophecies were a little off, but it's still going to happen. And, you know, and then the world still turns. And yeah, so I kind of was like, okay, I felt like Jonah, do you know what I mean? Like where God told Jonah to go to Nineveh and tell the people, you know, to repent and to, make things right, or else, you know, God's going to smite the city. And so then Jonah goes and he does the thing for God after being swallowed by the fish. And then God saves the city. And then Jonah's mm-hmm. mad about it. Mm-hmm. And I felt kind of like that because I was like, God, please don't end the world. I want to grow up and get married and have sex and have babies. Please don't end the world. And then when God didn't end the world, I was like, wait a minute. Is any of this true at yeah. all? Like, did my prayers work or is this just not real? And so that was kind of the turning point for me in early teen years to start to question everything that I had been told or taught or read up to that point. And yeah, I was homeschooled, and I play fast and loose with the term homeschooled because because when you're living out in the middle of nowhere waiting for the end of the world, there are so many things to do. And I just didn't do schoolwork. So my education took a really big hit as well. And then it wasn't until after we left that environment and, you know, moved somewhere else and I turned 16 and I was like, sweet, I can get my driver's license now. And my friends are getting their first jobs at McDonald's. Like, sweet, let's do that. Let's all hang out and work together and drive together and whatnot. And that's where I ran into trouble because I did not know that my mom had brought us into the country without paperwork. And
oh, wow.
I didn't exist at all. And because mom just thought, you know, the world is ending. Why bother with paperwork? Right?
Yeah.
So that started a journey of keeping this big secret and being an undocumented immigrant, essentially, and trying to fix it while also being terrified that the world was still going to end at some point. So that is the first half of my book.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting to me is there's this like obviously undercurrent of instability with the reality from what is many, I mean, 9, 10, 11 is like many of ours first well-formed memories. I have memories from younger ages that are very like all over the place. Yeah. But like that's right where you're starting to really get a fixed memory and having the uncertainty of the end of the world. And then, as you said, like, you know, 9/11, I remember, this is, you know, a divisive, anytime you talk about your age at 9/11, people are like, I talk to people I work with now and I'm like, they're like, I wasn't born. And I was like, and you're an adult? Like, what, how does that work?
Yeah, I was in college.
I was like, in sixth grade.
Math, but that doesn't seem right.
Pretty sure you can't be an adult if you weren't born before 9/11. But like, I remember being very terrified. I didn't have a ton of apocalypse anxiety to the extent that you're describing, but I remember it being definitely a very like feeling like, oh, this is that Revelations type of stuff that I heard about. And then to go into these stages, you talk about kind of moving into the stage of acceptance, like maybe the world won't end. I'll get my driver's license. I can have a life. And then you're met with this other sense of instability of like, your whole world could be changed because you could be, you know, kicked out of the country, you know, which is another whole layer of instability.
Yeah. And my mom, of course, her paranoia of government and everything else carried over into Canadian territory. And so she was very much like, you cannot tell anybody. You have to keep this a secret or else we're going to be in trouble. And, you know, if you need money, just work, do jobs under the table, babysit for people, like, you know, invent something. She wanted me to invent something.
Wow.
And I was like, I wasn't educated. Like, I can start a fire in the pouring rain if you want me to. But I can't invent something that is going to make me money. Like, this is not realistic. And yeah, so I didn't have schooling. I didn't have ID. I didn't have money. I very much was just almost hoping that the world would end sometimes just to have a reason for all of it and a and no longer watching my friends or the people around me just carry on and, you know, follow their dreams and do what they wanted to do and trying to field all their questions about me, because now I'm getting older and they're like, why don't you drive? Why don't you work? Like, what's going on? And feeling like I had to lie all the time. It was really stressful. And, yeah, so I think I had so much fear and so much, you know, because the stakes were really high, not just with the government or anything, but also with like you need to obey your parents. You need to honor your parents. And my mom was next to God in my belief system. And you know, like heaven and hell and, you know, not being raptured or not being raptured, you know, like it was just the stakes felt so high and I couldn't, and I just felt like, oh, I'm just such a worldly sinner, just wanting to get a job or
wanting to have ID.
Yeah. Like,
it's so interesting. Well, and it, I feel like no matter how, I don't know. I just feel like no matter what spectrum of how close to maybe perfect you were striving for, how, you know, how close to things, you always feel like this worldly person. You always feel like this, you know, depraved person because of the messaging that we get.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, and maybe I'm jumping ahead too much, but when did you start to question it? Because you mentioned that you're like, wait a second, the world didn't end. So was that my prayer or was that my, you know, this maybe just isn't true? It was that kind of a seed that led to like, maybe there's a lot more to question here than just this one particular conspiracy theory. When did it kind of start to unravel for you and what did that look like?
Well, I think I even describe it in my book as like that verse that Jesus talks about, you know, you just need faith the size of a mustard seed to grow a whole tree of belief or faith or whatever. And I say something in my book about, like, I wonder if the same can be said for a seed of doubt. Like, all it takes is just that tiny little question mark about something. And so I think, well, when Y2K didn't happen, I would have just turned 12. So that was like the first little moment. But I didn't have any agency or any freedom to question things. So I just was sort of in denial about it. Like, oh, it's just, it's late. It's gonna happen. It's just behind. And then I think, you know, even though we lived far out of town, we still tried to go into town fairly often so that my mom could go on the internet and study all of her Bible things and all of her conspiracy theory things to keep up on what was going on in the world. And she just kept saying dates to me, like, oh, this date is going to be important, or this something's going to happen here. And every time, nothing happened. And I think I just started to see that, wow, we are spending so much time and energy and money into something that is keeping on not happening. And my mom always said that, you know, she was like Noah, that God told Noah to build a boat, and it took him, you know, 100 years to build said boat, which gave people a lot of time to laugh at him and to mock him and not believe him. And yet it was, but yet it was still a true thing. So it, I kept being like, well, maybe this isn't true, but then, oh, right, Noah, you know. So we got to keep waiting. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I think this might be, I'm not as good at the Bible as I should be for someone formerly in ministry, but I think a lot of the narrative around Noah being made fun of for the boat is like extra biblical. Like there's not really that much even in the Bible about, like, it's like, people kind of like have.
I was just gonna say the same thing.
like we kind of made this whole story to like relate to like, yeah, they made fun of Noah too, but like I don't know that the Bible even says that. To be fair,
no, I don't think it does.
And you know, I think a lot of American evangelicalism is fed by a persecution complex. So,
1000%, yes.
So, if you feel that God is leading you to do something, and people are questioning that, then it must be the right path, right? So it makes you double down and triple down in some cases. So, it was like any time that I had doubts or questions about things, that was just something that I had to push away. And, but I think that really by the time that I turned, I would say 18 or 19, and I was babysitting for $5 an hour, and I was working every under the table job that I could find for $5 an hour, and I was exhausted and not going anywhere. I was just spinning my wheels, and I was like, you know what? I can't do this forever. Like, I can't pay rent. I can't buy groceries. I can't do anything. And if it means that I'm worldly by needing to be part of a system, then I guess God's just gonna have to, if he doesn't want me to be worldly, if he doesn't want me to be part of a system, then I guess he's just gonna have to end things because I can't do this anymore. And so it was kind of a test, I guess, on my part. I was testing God. Like, if I rebel against my mom, what are you gonna do about it? And everything that I did, every step that I took, it felt more and more right. And I felt more and more relief and more possibility that maybe there's a chance that I could have a life and have something to look forward to, because it had been just doom and gloom for so long. And I guess I'm just a Enneagram 2 who needs something to look forward to, you know?
Like, I know there are listeners that I can specifically visualize, a few Enneagram 2 listeners right now who are like, oh, I get that. That feels good to be seen, even though they may not ever admit it to themselves. Feels good to be seen.
And you know what? I'm not quite an astrology girly yet, but I know that I'm a Libra, and that part of that is all about balance. And I think that has come into play in my personality a lot, where it was just, I was so far over here and it wasn't working. And I was like, what if I just move a little bit over here? Could that help me out? And so I've been seeking balance pretty much my whole life. And and I'm here. I just turned 36. You know, the world has apocalypse type events every day, and yet it still turns. And I know that if I had not done what I did so long ago, I would probably be living in a really bad situation, or maybe not even be living anymore. Like, it was going to be that drastic. And and I believe probably the same for my mom as well, because she still believes that the world is going to end. She still believes all the same things. And she is alive and well because I have insisted that she, you know, take care of herself. And I'm helping her, like, you know, get Social Security and all these kinds of things. Like, I think there's a larger generation of older people that spent so much time and energy and money investing in the church and investing in
the idea that, oh, God's going to come back any day now, that now they have nothing to fall back on, like no plans for retirement, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of older evangelical people who are financially struggling and struggling with everything else because they just did not prepare. They prepared for everything but getting old, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for every disaster except for no disaster happening and having to just get old.
Yeah. You know, and then something like the pandemic happens and my mom thought and still thinks that it's all a scam, that it's not real. So there's just this cognitive dissonance. And so every time that I have a conversation with her about how I grew up or about the pandemic or anything like that, I'm just like, man, I'm so glad that I listened to my, I don't know if it was my intuition or something. I listened to something inside myself that said, you need to fix this because it's not going to end well. So yeah. And now I don't know what I believe anymore. If I believe.
Well, and that's what I was just going to say. Like, there, yeah, exactly. Welcome. But there's a lot to sift through because it's not only high control, it's not only conspiracy, it's also isolation too. And it's also all tied into spirituality. And so in some ways it reminds me of some of like what I've seen come out of the Duggar journey when it comes to that, like there's layers upon layers of, it's not just evangelicalism, but on top of that, it's one very specific school of thought. And on top of that, then you're being isolated away from other people. And the only way to kind of discover truth or your own truth is to interact with other people and follow that, what you're talking about, your kind of intuition or your gut that says something about this doesn't feel right. But then you also are fighting this internal feeling of, but yet I kind of feel like it's rebellious to follow that. And so that, I'm just curious, like after kind of sifting through, because this has happened over the course of what sounds like a long time, like years, after sifting through, what was that process like for you of kind of unpacking, okay, let's kind of separate the threads here and let's see like what my values are and what's important to me. And I know there's so many of us that I've had conversations with people that are like, if you're not finding this in the Bible, how are you not murdering people? You know, like, what? Yeah. And so, but of course we have our own values and ethics and things like that. So what was that kind of rediscovery like for you? And cause you've also talked about your sexuality a little bit on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what has helped me, grounded me, given me clarity is the other piece of being raised in evangelicalism is that I was raised mostly by white people and I thought that I was white and I did not know, because my mom was a single mom her whole life, I did not know that my father is an indigenous Mexican man and that there's a whole cultural belief and ancestral like knowledge that comes with that. So looking back now, all of the times that I felt doubt or that I wished that God was bigger than a judgmental dictator, essentially, all of the times that I wished that there was more to the story than just God and Jesus and death and feeling guilty all the time. That was actually my ancestral like knowledge coming through. So the being able to essentially Google my family ancestry on my dad's side and learn what they believe and what was almost wiped out by Christianity and Catholicism, has been a reclaiming journey for me as well. And going, oh, that makes sense why I hoped this, or I thought this, or I dreamed this. Like, I was having dreams about the world ending because my mom and I saw a war movie the night before. And so, of course, I'm going to have terrifying nightmares about that and think that they're prophetic predictions. But I was also having dreams of places I'd never been, and flowers and landscape and animals and things that I had never seen before. And, you know, to then Google later where my ancestors come from in Mexico, it's like, oh, all these pieces started to come together. And I could learn what was missing my whole life, essentially. And so I talk about that a fair amount in the book as well. And the coming into my own sexuality as a bi woman, or indigiqueer, as we sort of coin that together, is knowing that before colonization, there was so much wider acceptance of various orientations, or more than two genders. Like, that, like, my people, my ancestors, were all open to that. And so for me to go from being afraid of God and afraid of being honest about who I was or what I wanted to believe, it went from that to being, oh, I was actually created by a divine being to be the way that I am. And I don't have to be afraid, and I don't have to live wondering if the world is going to end today, and I don't have to try to save other people. I don't have to try to police their souls and their salvation. And, like, it set me free, essentially, from living in that place of fear and putting it on other people at the same time. Because I was a good little evangelist, you know. I was worried about people. Like, I was telling them, you know, when the rapture happens, you don't want to get left behind, right? Like, I was so invested. And now my son is 7 and my daughter is 5 and a half, and they've never even heard about Jesus or the Bible or anything other than a creator that, and ancestors and spirit that watches over them or loves them or whatever. Nothing but positive, you know, belief. And I remember thinking when I was young that, oh, if I get to grow up, if I get to get married and have children, I'm going to raise them, you know, this way, this way, this way, that very Duggar-like, like you mentioned. And we knew so many families that were like the Duggars. And I was like trying to get one of those boys to fall in love with me so that we could have 6 babies and raise the next generation of God's little soldiers, you know, like.
Only 6, not 16.
A modest Duggar family.
And now I have 2 and I'm like, that's too many.
Yeah.
No, it's just
enough. That's how I felt about being a stay-at-home mom. I remember, because I was a teacher when I had my kids, and I remember, like, looking forward to going back to work and being like, I had always thought that I would be at home with my kids. And is there something wrong with me that I actually like to have that separation between, I go someplace during the day and they have people that cherish them and nourish them while I'm gone. And then I come back and I have the energy to still be a mom then. Like, I remember that too, because I think the script we're given and then how we envision that to be isn't always how reality works out. And
yeah, no.
Doesn't paint the picture of the difficulty of motherhood, too.
No. Oh, my gosh. I just can't even picture myself fitting into that mold anymore.
Yeah.
I want to ask about the fear, because, you know, there's this very tangible, very I can feel the presence of fear in the way you describe much of your childhood and much of your experience of the divine and of religion and faith. And as you talk about the way that you have, you know, been able to learn and explore these aspects of your ancestry and of your identity and these narratives that are free from this sort of fear, while at the same time, many of these identities are very marginalized, mm-hmm. very at risk, very historically oppressed. And so how do you manage fear now as a person who faces real tangible threats in terms of being a queer Indigenous person? The threats are not quite as elusive as Y2K. And so I'm sure that you mm-hmm. still deal with fear. How do you process that as who you are now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a phrase that often comes to my mind, and I don't know where it came from, but it's the fact that so many church people, whatever denomination or brand they are, that they're so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. And I think that the earthly good part plays into the marginalization and the oppression that you mentioned, that, you know, that the church or evangelical people, they're so heavenly minded that they don't see how they're causing hell on earth in so many ways. And so I think that my goal has been to root through the trauma of religious fear of hell and everything else, and to recognize that that's not necessarily real. Like, I might feel triggered by something, but that doesn't mean that it's a real issue. The real issues are what is happening to people here on Earth right now. And I've had to wrestle with knowing that I belong to multiple communities and hold multiple identities that are oppressed and are marginalized, while also realizing that, how do I say this? I don't want to say that I'm privileged to pass as something else. Like, I'm married to a cisgender man, so, you know, nobody looking at me might assume that I'm not straight. Or, you know, it's winter time right now, so I'm super pale and I don't necessarily look like an Indigenous person. Like, I pass sometimes, and it's not a privilege because it's erasure, if that makes sense. But I also know that if people are assuming that I am straight or white, then I have to out myself over and over and over again. And I have to choose which situations feel like I'm going to be welcomed or not welcomed, and do I have the energy to deal with not being welcomed today? So it's tricky. I remember growing up and being in a group of kids, and they always asked me, "What are you?" Because they could tell that I was different, but they couldn't like label me as something. Like any Native kids that I hung out with, they always, you know, asked me what tribe I was from. And what any time I was hanging out with non-Native kids, they always assumed I lived on a reservation or something. Like I just never belonged in one group or another. I was always in between and in a liminal space, or never really knowing where I belonged or who I belonged to. And so the more that I come into my Indigenous identity and my queer identity, I hope that it becomes more obvious in my appearance or in the way that I talk or my aura or whatever people read about me, because I don't want to hide that about myself, even if it makes things more difficult for me. And I want to raise my children to know that they are also Indigenous and that they have a queer mom. I want to be open about those things. And so it's, I've mostly had trouble with embracing those identities in online spaces, not really in person yet, but that's just because I don't hang out in-person spaces that much. And it's challenging just because in online spaces, there's a lot of gatekeeping about who belongs to which community. And so if I claim that I am bisexual, but I've never been with someone who's not a cisgender man, then do I really belong? And I might claim that I am Indigenous, but if I am not a registered citizen of the Pasquayaki Nation that I come from, then am I actually Indigenous? So I still, on both sides of those communities, I still don't belong. In their eyes, I still don't belong anywhere. So that I don't get persecuted, or I don't get bullied or marginalized for claiming those things. I get it from both sides saying that you're not really this. It's weird. And I get imposter syndrome a lot of the time. So, you know, I see you both nodding like maybe you're you're familiar.
Yeah. Couple erased bisexuals here in full agreement.
I think we should maybe come up with like a secret bisexual handshake since we're all here and we're all bi, and yeah. We just, you know, solidify that, and then we can all just validate each other's existence and presence in the community.
Feels correct.
If we all just sit awkwardly in chairs around each other.
Yeah. 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 I've got at least three beverages right here.
I am curious. So when you thinking about like the process of writing your book, and so I actually, you kind of joked, like, did we all write a book during the pandemic? I also wrote a book during the pandemic.
You did.
But I would say I did. And it was, I started the pandemic like pretty evangelical, and it's a very evangelical memoir that will never see the light of day. But it kind of kicked off my, it kind of kicked off my deconstruction, because like writing through my story made me face some things that I had never really questioned and encountered. And I'm wondering, like, from your perspective, then, What was that process like? Did you face some things that you're like, oh, I've never really kind of processed this? Or was it, and I think in some ways it was kind of healing for me to go through all of that, mm-hmm. and there were pieces of my story that I had a lot of shame about, and I was like, wait a second, that was just evangelical shame. Mm-hmm. Like, this was actually like a good moment in my life that I should celebrate. And so I think I'm just curious, like, going through all of those bits, and I mean, starting from, I think you said age 3, and then going through kind of your whole story, was that something that, were you faced with things that were activating? Was that a healing process for you? Were you kind of deconstructing in the midst of that, even some of those things that you were writing through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And would you or would you not recommend it for others?
Yeah, well, I only just finished editing the book like last week, and I thought I wasn't gonna survive. So if you had asked me that question last week, I would say I don't recommend this. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting for me to essentially start from like age 3 and go through different things and think like, oh, actually there's like large chunks of time that I don't remember. Did I block that out? Was I traumatized maybe? And starting to write things down also like shook some other things loose. And I'm like, oh, I forgot about that. And it was traumatizing all over again. And I only had a therapist in my life for maybe the first 6 months of writing that book. It's been really eye-opening for me. And I'm also a little bit surprised at how brave I got telling a few of those stories, because there's a few in there that I have not even told to in person to my closest friends, and out of shame probably. And I wanted to find a way to tell those stories in a way that was, not like it made me a little bit vulnerable maybe, but I was not ashamed of those parts of me or that experience anymore. And I think, you know, they say that when you tell stories, that shame kind of loses its power a little bit. And I think I felt that, and I still don't know how a lot of people are going to respond to some of those stories because they haven't read it yet. So it remains to be seen. But I feel, I think I saw so much of this young version of me that was essentially, I don't know if I want to say brainwashed, but just conditioned to believe certain things and to act in a certain way. And yeah, I think maybe it helped that I'm a mom now and I have small children, and I was like picturing myself at their ages and going, oh man, that was a lot for a little Carly to go through. I'm not going to be mad at her about that anymore. I'm going to give her a hug, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, once I got the original story out of me, I felt like, okay, it's good. It's all there. All the bones are there. And then I had to go back into editing, and the editor, I have a great relationship with my editor, but she, the way she like wrote her notes was very abrupt. Like, why did you say this? Or what were you thinking here? Or can we can we get rid of this and put something else here? And so I was having to suddenly be very clinical about some really traumatic or just deep, like things that meant something to me. It was now under this very clinical microscope, essentially. And I could like make myself focus and do it and get the job done. And then I would go to bed for the rest of the day and just crash because, I was like, I can't do this anymore. And now that the editing is done and the writing is done and I have seen the whole thing from beginning to end, I'm like, oh, this is a beautiful, like, character arc, maybe in a way,
yeah.
That everything makes sense now. And, that it's something that I can be proud of, even if somebody else out there reads it and condemns me for it. It's I own it now and I'm proud of it. And I love, what this has turned into. And I hope that one day my kids will read it when they are a lot older. And it's all, I think, you know, I'm bi, I'm Indigenous and white, you know, for me things are always just gonna be more than one thing. It's always gonna be, I don't want to say both because that sounds like it's only two things, but it's always going to be more than one thing. And so, yes, it's traumatizing and yes, it's healing and yes, it's hard work and yes, it's freeing. Like it's just all those things. And, I remember the day before my deadline was due, I was just staring at my computer and sobbing for like an hour because I was like, I just want everybody to be happy with me. I want the queer community to be happy and feel well represented. I want the Indigenous community to be happy and well represented. I want the disability and medical community that I'm a part of to feel happy and well represented. And I just felt such like, it was a lot of pressure, but it was a huge honor to hold all of these spaces and all of these identities and, you know, hopefully make something that represents those communities well. And also, if somebody is not happy with it, then I'm okay with that too.
Well, on behalf of the bisexual contingent, let Megan and I assure you that we are happy with you.
I'm telling you, secret handshake. It sounds like you said you were an Enneagram 2, but it sounds like you have a pretty strong Enneagram 1 wing, because I resonate with a lot of that, trying to do what's best for everybody in the world and reduce harm for everybody in the world and not add harm into that. And I feel that deeply.
Yeah.
Cortland, I don't know if you had another question. I wanted to ask where people, if I know we're catching you early on the kind of cycle of promoting your book, but I do want to ask where people, if it's available
it's
for pre-order
too early
yet.
To pre-order, right? We got pre-orders. They're ready. We
can. So I, on social media, I am just the same username because I have enough passwords to remember as it is. So I just keep it universal. Carly M. Button. My last name is Butler, and my husband's last name is Hutton. So we got real cute with it and just call ourselves the Buttons. And so...
That is cute. I like that.
The best.
Carly M. Button on Twitter or X, whatever we're calling it nowadays, on Instagram, on TikTok, on all the things. And I have posted in my bio, my little link tree, and there's lots of places to pre-order my book. I do want to give a disclaimer that if people are listening from the States, that for some reason, books release 3 to 6 months later in the US than they do in Canada. So in Canada, my book release date is March 15th, 2024. And in the US, it is probably June 15th, 2024. So if you are an American, you probably have a lot of time to pre-order.
Okay, but I'm not that far from Canada. Could I go and just buy some books in March and just bring them over the border? Because I might need to update my passport, but I'm about 5 hours from Victoria. Oh, so I could do that, right?
That is where my publisher is. My publisher is on, is on Vancouver Island, so...
Megan's right. going to be running that black market Canadian book side hustle.
Hey, from being smuggled over the border illegally as a child to having my book smuggled over the border, there's nothing more I could ask for.
It's a perfect round full circle.
Yes.
We'll definitely put a link to your link tree as well as many other links in the show notes for this episode as well. And I'll just give the disclaimer or the rant or the thing that listeners know that I'm going to do about pre-ordering and why it's important and why, you know, we just had Pastor Trey on the podcast.
Oh,
who
yeah.
His book just released. We've had a lot of people. We usually have people a few weeks to a few months before their book comes out. And I'm always yelling, Rahati. I think that was one he was like, can you just say that in a clip that I can then I was like fucking pre-order the book. It really matters. I just think that we live in a society and in a culture where we know we can wait till it comes out and we can order it and it's prime and it will come in 2 days. And so we don't think about as consumers why it's important, but it says a ton to the publishers, to the distributors, mm-hmm. to the bookstores to have those orders stacking up in terms of how they're going to spend their marketing money and what they're going to do to push the book. So go and pre-order the book.
And if you're in Canada, there's actually a very specific link on my link tree called 49th Shelf. And if you go to it and then hit the shop local button, it basically uses a map with your postal code in it and finds all the independent bookstores within 100 kilometers of you. And that is actually a very helpful way to get me onto Canadian bestseller lists. I don't know what our equivalent of New York Times bestseller list is, but they use websites like 49th Shelf to calculate from all the independent Canadian bookstores about who is a bestseller in Canada or not. So I highly recommend that for Canadian listeners.
Nice.
And then, yeah, for American listeners, I don't know.
I was going to say, go follow Carly on Twitter because you're a great follow and I've had a lot of great dialogue and interaction with you there.
I agree.
That's how we came across each other and got this interview set up. And I really appreciate you taking that time to sit with us. But yeah, I hope people go and check you out on the socials too.
And you know what? You wouldn't know this about me because we've only ever interacted on Twitter before, but I've done a couple of podcasts before and I have to constantly hold myself back from saying, all the time or crying. And I didn't do any of that today. I mean, maybe when we listen back, we'll hear a lot more ums, but, you know, it's gross.
No, you did. Fabulous.
Yeah, you did excellent. I was engrossed fully in the story. I'm so excited to get your book, and I'm so excited to release this episode.
And you only know the half of it.
Awesome.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That was so good. I've missed having guests. It's always nice to have somebody to chat with. I love talking to you, Cortland.
Thanks. Thanks. I appreciate the afterthought. No offense. I'm just kidding. I agree. Having a guest is always, and we've had some incredible guests that we've been kind of sitting on these interviews. And so it's nice to get them out there and share them with the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Check out Carly's work, pre-order her book, and also check out the contentwarningevent.com and grab that ticket for the virtual if you haven't, or even if you're in the Portland area or if you're able to make it to the Portland area, come in person.
If you start driving right now, you could probably make it to Portland by Friday, I bet.
Perfect.
from almost anywhere. Follow us, the show, Thereafter Podcast on Instagram, at Thereafter Pod on Twitter, and Patreon, patreon.com/thereafterpod. Where else, Megan? Where can people find you?
I'm at The Pursuing Life in all the places. And yeah, I think that's it.
I'm at Portland Coffee, all the places. Come give us a follow and check out all the links in the bios. And we'll be back with you next time for another episode. Probably next week. We'll see.
Sounds good. All right. Until next time.